Greer on WNYC, and humans have been struggling with questions about life and death since the beginning of time. How does life begin? What does it mean? What happens when you're dead? My next guest, Jill Lepore, provides a history of how Americans have answered these questions in her newest book, The Mansion of Happiness, A History of Life and Death. Jill Lepore is a professor of American history at Harvard University, a staff writer at The New Yorker, and the author of several books, as many of you know. Professor Lepore, Jill, welcome back to WNYC. Hi.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So you've laid the book out like The Game of Life, or as you've titled the book, The Mansion of Happiness, taking us from Hatched, which is about conception and birth, to Resurrection, which looks at the cryogenics movement and the possibility of life after death. What's the big picture of what you're trying to accomplish with this book?
Well, you know, within the ivory tower, we always get these assaults, you know, you academics, you write more and more about less and less, you know, you read these tiny little monographs about nothing. So I thought, well, I'll write a book about the history of ideas of life and death. Actually, there is a kind of a big picture, but there's also a lot of smaller pictures that I think add up to an observation that there's been a dramatic shift in how we live our lives, just as a matter of the length of our lives and the number of children we have, the demographic transition over the last couple centuries. You know, people live twice as long and have a quarter the number of children that they had two centuries ago. And as a culture, I don't think we've really kind of wrestled with that. There's kind of a mismatch, a misfit between the sort of social structure that describes how we live our lives and our cultural adaptation to those things. So the book is really an attempt to kind of look at that at different moments of the life cycle.
And quite a bit of it is about science and technology and its impact, their impact on our ideas about life and death and even mortality. Earlier in the show, we had some guests who maybe you know, Aisha and Parag Khanna, who've written a book now called Hybrid Reality, Thriving in the Emerging Human Technology Civilization. And they're all about these hybridizations that actually are taking place. Like the woman they talked about who can think through a chip that's implanted in her brain that controls her prosthetic arm. So are you kind of onto the same path as them in a way?
I think I'm objecting to the path. I'm more chronicling how we got to the place we're at with
yeah,
that kind of
so
stuff.
Are they, but
so,
go ahead.
Yeah. I mean not objecting to these wonderful devices that are going to help people lead, you know, more useful lives and happier lives, but asking us to think a little bit harder about the set of ideas that bring us to a place where we, I think, often accept without much thought those kinds of developments. So I'm really looking at one of the things that I argue in the book is that our notion of life itself has kind of changed from a circular one to a linear one. And you can date that really to the Enlightenment with the idea of improvement, that life is getting better and better and better and life will get longer and longer and longer. And in the 19th century, the age of progress, the notion of progress became kind of the key word of the culture. And progress was really measured in machines. The every generation would bring about a better, faster machine that could do more work for man. And in the 20th century, we kind of changed the language from improvement to progress to innovation. We also talk about evolution, but all these concepts are sort of these forward-thinking, progress-oriented, very linear notions, not only of how we lead our own lives, but how we are moving as a civilization. And that actually is itself a huge shift because previous to the kind of linear revolution, most people in most civilizations in the West and elsewhere had a much more cyclical or circular notion of how we lead our lives and how societies, how empires rise and fall, for instance, how we are born in ashes and die in ashes, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. This sort of life was a kind of seasonal affair, that your children replaced you. There were kind of all kinds of ways in which life seemed to go round and round and round. And the abdication of that notion, I think, is probably the most profound shift.
So you write about, for example, the growth of hospitals and intensive care units prolonging dying, respirators and the definition of brain dead, the concept of childhood, which you say came from parents wanting to protect their children from the age of progressivism, the age of machines. Can you talk about that one, how technology has influenced our concept of childhood in this country?
Well, technology, the technological revolutions of the 19th century are also associated with urbanization. So families who, you know, this country was largely rural throughout most of the 19th century, but the shift really began around 1820 or so. People built factories. Machines were making goods that couldn't that were no longer being made at home. The Industrial Revolution and the communications and technological revolutions that are a part of it brought people into cities and also separated, in some ways, young people from their families. And there came to be a much greater sense that home was a very different place than work, that work was a place you went to, and home was a place you came home to, you returned to at the end of your workday, that home was a place where women and children were that was different from the male world of work, and a whole set of ideas about domesticity and this femininity of children, the inherent innocence and the idea, the replacement of the idea that children are sort of born evil and need to be broken with the idea that children are born innocent and need to be protected from the sort of smutty, grimy, filthy, industrial, machine-oriented world. And so there's this whole culture in the 19th century, this whole culture of childhood innocence that is responsible for a lot of our notions about childhood but kind of bumps up against many more competing realities of how children lead their lives in the ways in which children are not actually protected from some kind of larger, grittier world than the world of home.
You write about the breast pump somewhat in this context. Why that?
Well, a lot of the pieces of the book, really, I should confess, kind of emerged from ordinary objects in my daily life that I kind of puzzle over. So the book, a lot of the book is about games of life that, you know, like the Milton Bradley game that, I don't know, you probably played as a kid, I played as a kid. The Mansion of Happiness was a board game in the 19th century. But I wrote about the breast pump because, you know, one day I was at work in my office attached to this breast pump pumping breast milk. And I just, you know, hated every – I've always hated the whole breast pump thing. And I just kind of got stuck with – like, how did it come to this? Why am I attached to this machine that is pumping fluids from my body in place of – nursing my children? Like, what set of historical circumstances got us here? And that's the kind of question I really love to ask and kind of run off into the archives and try to come up with an answer for. And there's some kind of sinister explanations that are kind of important to think about. One is that breast pumps are largely marketed in the United States where they have a very healthy sales record because they replace maternity leave. So we have very bad maternity leave policies in the United States compared to other similar countries. And what corporations do and what a lot of employers do is give breast pumps to women when they have a child and tell them to come back to work. How that came to pass is a really interesting story. It goes back to Linnaeus, the botanist who decided that mammals were mammals and that the defining thing about human beings as and mammals was that women nurse their young. It goes back to Darwin and notions of the idea, a kind of social Darwinist idea that comes out of Darwin's writings in the United States that as Darwin's writings are received in the United States, that women are going to evolve out of the nursing function. So there's this kind of like crazy tangle of ideas that gets you, you know, all the way up in time to this moment where all over the country, women are hooked up to breast pumps.
My guest on WNYC is Jill Lepore, the Harvard history professor and New Yorker staff writer. Her new book is called The Mansion of Happiness, A History of Life and Death. It's a history of how Americans have perceived questions of life and death and the life cycle throughout the cycle of the life of this country. We've fostered some pretty absurd beliefs in the name of science, as you point out, the eugenics movement, you know, that women with college educations are less suitable mates, African Americans have smaller brains, the formula for, you know, that formula is more scientific than breast milk, all of these things that you allude to. How does it make you think about science? Why would more advanced science and technology muddy our understanding of the world rather than clarify it?
I think partly because we have less skepticism toward it. It works as a secular faith for a lot of people. It also doesn't work as a secular faith for a lot of people. That's why we have the denial of climate change, for instance. I mean, there's I think, more recently a response to scientific inquiry and scientific knowledge that comes out of fundamentalism. And those two things are always in tension in American history. Kind of the rise of fundamentalism is always associated with shifts in faith and scientific understandings of the world. I think partly we do kind of buy into, and I'm by no means outside of this. I mean, it's fun as a historian to look back at different moments where suddenly kind of becomes clear, oh, yeah, that was a kooky idea. But the kooky ideas of our own time are very hard for us to see, right? If we could see them, then they wouldn't be so prominent. But or if we could see their kookiness. I think that there's a kind of shift in the locus of cultural authority. So even if you think about, like, think about being in a hospital with someone who's dying, you know, in an ICU room, something, you know, most of us have spent a lot of hours of our lives doing and surely will. That's a relative historical novelty, right? Just even being in an ICU rooms are new. That people die in hospitals are new. The machines that are used there are new. And, you know, previous generations, there would be different ways of understanding how to deal with death, and there would be different kinds of people you would talk to think about what's going on. You might talk to your minister, you might talk to your rabbi. Many people, of course, still do those things, but it's actually kind of, in some ways, the influence of secularism that means that there's very little to actually go to for any kind of authority of understanding what's going on in that ICU room except the machine itself.
Yeah. In the early 50s, Life magazine published photographs of fetuses at various stages of development, and you refer to them throughout your book. Why were these photos so significant for you?
Well, just as a citizen watching our American political conversations get so seized up over the question of abortion, you can't help but be interested in how that began. What are the origins of our current kind of political impasse? Because the question of the right to life, I think, pervades most political conversations. Is a huge part, for instance, of the healthcare debate. I mean, just think about the last year and the kind of the debates over the insurance coverage of contraception. So it's not just abortion, it's contraception now. But there's also kind of the whole right to die. And if we think about how much questions of life and death affect our political conversation, even when we're not talking about life and death, we actually are talking about life and death because they're now so much the base of our political conversation. So as a historian, I'm really interested in how that started because, of course, that's not always been the case. It's actually relatively recent. It really doesn't start until the late 60s and early 70s, and it doesn't become intractable until the 1980s. It's really only a couple decades old, which I find kind of reassuring because that means it is someday going to end. But one of the places that you really see it actually taking hold is in this set of photographs that Life publishes, one of which is on its cover in 1965, which happens to be the year that the Supreme Court handed down its decision in Griswold, Connecticut, making contraception legal. And there it initiates this whole set of conversations across the culture. You can just kind of see it rippling out immediately, like within a week, how this just the physical, the visual representation of the fetus as independent from a woman's body. The whole thing about these photographs is that the story is called The Drama of Life, but actually the fetuses and embryos that are depicted in those pages are dead. They're the products of abortions and hysterectomies and miscarriages. But the whole idea is that you could represent this life outside of a woman's body really does have a huge effect on how that subject becomes political.
Although I guess if suddenly we could see sonograms and hear fetal heartbeats and all these things that technology enabled, that it only makes sense that that would influence our moral understanding about what it means to be in the womb, right?
Sure. It's not nonsense that it changes how we think, but it's just that it's traceable.
Shifting gears for a minute, in our last couple of minutes, you have a piece in this week's New Yorker, which is a look at the Supreme Court's history leading up to its decision on the constitutionality of the Health Care Affordability Act, which is imminent. And if I read it correctly, you seem to imply that the court has always paid attention to politics in this realm, right?
Yeah. One thing that's been kind of great about this Supreme Court year is that a lot of people have been paying attention to the Supreme Court and wondering why it is the way it is. And that's actually really useful. As a historian, as a teacher, you know, it's fun to be able to sort of look at that and say, actually, for instance, things that we assume to have been, I don't know, kind of timeless political truths in the United States, that Supreme Court justices would serve for life, or that there would be 9 of them, or that the Supreme Court has the right to void acts of Congress. None of these things are actually timeless. The serving for life comes out of a very long political history involving Parliament's dispute with the king. The number of justices has changed over time. There were 5, there were 6, there were 10, there were 9. Once there were going to be 17. There were used to never be clerks. The Supreme Court used to be a trial court. They used to ride circuit. They never had their own building until 1935 when the controversy of the New Deal was waged in that new building. So one of the things that I think the healthcare debate is really useful for reminding us about is that the appeals that are often made, especially by conservatives, to kind of the timeless original political truths in the United States that mean that we can't do this or we can't do that, they're never as timeless as they are made to appear.
Does history suggest to you how they'll decide that case?
No, see, historians were only really allowed to look backward. We have a kind of twisted neck.
Looking backward, but with a lot of context about the present and even the future, is Jill Lepore, a Harvard historian and New Yorker staff writer. Her new book is The Mansion of Happiness, A History of Life and Death. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next, we continue our June series about online dating with Charles Orlando from the dating site Your Tango. He's the author of The Problem with Women is Men, and he'll take your call. Stay tuned.